The main things.
Of what?
Interest. Not allowed to charge interest. The prohibition against interest is a very, very unique aspect of Jewish business ethics because it is almost the only ethical rule that is limited to my relationship to another Jew. So, for example, all of the various halachos regarding cheating and lying, misrepresentation, and of course, as we discussed, failure to disclose in halacha, not telling the truth is the same as lying. So there was an old Massachusetts case about a house that was termite infested and it collapsed, and the buyer wanted his money back, and the common law rule had been what is called caveat emptor, that the buyer must beware that in the absence of any type of lying, there is no basis for misrepresentation. Well, in Jewish law and halacha, that rule is rejected, and it's very, very clear in halacha that failure to tell the truth is a basis for what is called geneva stas, for misrepresentation, and a buyer in Jewish law has the right to cancel a transaction and get his money back. Now, those laws apply whether you're dealing with a Jew or a goy. Right? Contrary to popular opinion, it's very, very clear that one is not allowed to cheat a non-Jew at all. However, the laws against interest are very unique. The laws against interest, however, only apply in my relationship to a Jew. They do not apply in my relationship to a non-Jew. This is explicit in the Torah itself. The Torah says, "Li'achicha lo sashich," do not take a bite out of your brother. Interest is called neshech. But then it says specifically, "Esanochri tashich," you may take a bite out of the nochri, out of the non-Jew. Now there is a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban. Does this mean you may or you must? According to some opinions, there is actually a mitzvah to lend a goy money at interest rather than give him an interest-free loan. According to most opinions, it is not a mitzvah. It is simply something you're allowed to do. If you want to make a free loan, present a hate, that's fine. But there is at least a permission. So in that sense, it's very unique. And this apparently represents the idea that charging interest for money is not something that is intrinsically evil. To use the Latin, it is not malum per se, it's malum prohibitive, meaning to say certain types of laws, certain types of mitzvahs, reflect the idea that they are intrinsically immoral. They are evil, and therefore God prohibited them, meaning some things Hashem prohibits because they are considered evil. Other things become evil only by virtue of God's prohibition. So, for example, one might say, although many people dispute this characterization, one might say that murdering somebody, killing somebody, is something that is intrinsically evil based on the nature that God created in the world, and therefore the prohibition, thou shalt not murder, does not create the immorality of the act. It simply reflects the fact that the act is already evil. Interest, apparently, is not of that nature. There is nothing apparently intrinsically evil about charging somebody interest for money. It becomes evil only because the Torah prohibits it. Consequently, anything beyond the scope of the prohibition would not be an aveira, would not be sinful, and there would not even be an idea of going beyond the letter of the law in this matter, because there is nothing intrinsically evil. And in fact, we discussed, this is just a brief review for those who weren't here, we discussed the philosophical issue here, and that is, how come if I have a car and I want to rent you my car, I can charge you rent for my car? In other words, I can charge you for the privilege of using my property. There is no aveira in renting out my car, in renting out my house. Why all of a sudden is there a concept that I cannot charge you rent for my money? If I give you money and you want to hold on to that money for 6 months or for 1 year, why could you not perceive of interest as simply being the economic rent that is payable for money? So why is money different than a car or a piece of furniture or a computer or anything else? Now, of course, there is a halachic difference. In other words, if we were to ask a halachic scholar, what is the difference? Why isn't rent on an object considered interest? Well, the answer is because the laws of interest apply only to the lending of objects which are spent and consumed, not only money. Money is the common example. I lend you money. You're not going to give me back the same dollar bills. You're going to spend it. and give me something else, well, interest would apply to food as well. If I lend you a bushel of grain, which you use to eat and consume, you cannot pay me back with more grain or more value. So it's not that interest only applies to money. That much is true. But interest only applies to what are called lending transactions. And a lending transaction refers to when something is consumed, when something is used up, as opposed to when I lend you something and you're supposed to give it back to me. In fact, even in halakha, there are two different terms that are used for that. When I lend you something that you consume and use up and give me back a replacement, that is called halva'a. Halva is lending. When I lend you something with the understanding that you're going to give me back the same object, that is called she'ela. And in short, ribis applies to halva'a. Ribis does not apply to she'ela. I'm sorry, you want to say?
Yeah, well, commission.
Commission on
is that allowed? No, Jim?
Like a sales commission?
But just in the case, I want to get an exchange, say, traveler's check for shekels. And the person told me that they charge a commission.
Yeah. Generally speaking, if it's simply charging a commission for a service of changing money, that is permitted. Yeah. Yeah. But it's discussed. It does raise potentially an interesting question, but we're lenient on it. Okay. So the point about interest is, number one, it's very unique because it only applies to a Jew, and number two, it's unique because it seems to differentiate conceptually the idea of halva from the idea of she'ela, and it does not consider interest to be a legitimate rental charge for money. See, this is why it's a little... The standard explanation for the laws against interest really are not really that encompassing. For example, you'll see in the Sefer Achinuch, for example, the classic reason why we don't charge interest is because we have to recognize that all of our resources come from God. God gave us our money. God gave us our ability to make wealth. Consequently, we have to make it available for people who need it as a matter of charity, as a matter of benevolence. And as you know, the highest form of charity is giving people loans so that they will be able to become self-sufficient. But the problem is that the Sefer Achinuch's explanation does not adequately differentiate between the halva category and the she'ela category. I mean, after all, why is money treated in a stricter way than a car or anything else? So one would still need a bit of an explanation. But just for our general overview, that is a second reason why interest is unique. So the first reason is, it is really the only fundamental ethical business practice for which we make a discrimination between a Jew and a non-Jew. Number two, the difference between she'ela and halva. But number three, there's another curious distinction, which is absolutely unique in the annals of all halachas regarding money. That is, normally, anything that pertains to monetary obligations, I owe you money, or I have a right against you, or you have a right against me, that can always be readjusted by waiver, by mechila. So if I owe you $100, you could tell me, you don't have to pay me, right? That's called amochel you, right? Amochel, I waive it, I forgive it. Or the opposite, if I don't owe you money and I decide I want to pay you voluntarily, perfectly fine. If I want to pay you voluntarily, right? Let's say, for example, that let's assume that I was a shomer for you. You asked me to watch something for you while you went across the street. And you didn't pay me to be a shomer, right? So I'm called a shomer chinam. Shomer chinam is one who watches the object without compensation. Shomer chinam. Now the halacha is, a shomer chinam is obligated to pay for damage to the object if the damage occurred because he was negligent or careless. If, on the other hand, a bolt of lightning, you know, struck the thing and it broke, or an accident, or there was an earthquake and it broke, a shomer chinam doesn't have to pay. In fact, even a shomer sacher, even a compensated person wouldn't have to pay for something like that. But if I want to pay you, if I say I feel bad, and I should have gotten earthquake insurance or whatever it is, and then you would have gotten paid, I'm perfectly free to do so. In other words, the general rule is, if the Torah says a rule, one person owes money to somebody else, or one person doesn't owe money to somebody else, whichever party has the advantage of that rule is able to be mochel it and pay if they want. Right? No one's going to stop you. The one exception in the entire Torah is the law of interest. Very, very unique. The law of interest says, not only am I not allowed to charge you interest, because I'm not allowed to take you to court and try to collect interest, I'm not allowed to force you to pay interest, I cannot create an obligation on you to pay interest, but even if out of the kindness of your heart, you want to pay me something extra, you want to go over to me and say, hey, you know, I really got a lot of use out of this money, I really appreciate the loan, let me pay you an extra 10%. The halacha is that that is prohibited as well. Okay, so interest is very unique, that even the victim, so to speak, does not have the power to override that law of interest by deciding to make voluntary payments. And in fact, in halacha, there's even discussions about expressing gratitude for loans, because if I'm giving you, right, if I'm giving you back the money and I say thank you, right, potentially there's an interest issue. All right, so there we discussed that common courtesies and little favors that don't have an economic value in many cases were lenient, but the very fact that the question is raised shows us how unique the law of interest is. And in fact, the Gemara goes on and says that any collection of interest is considered to be theft, and in fact not only does the creditor sin by collecting interest, the borrower sins by giving interest. The witnesses who sign on a note that's an interest-bearing note are committing a sin as facilitators of a forbidden transaction, and they are from now on puzzled. They are ineligible to be to be witnesses under Jewish law until they do tshuva.
What about banks?
Okay, so that's what I want to go over. I just want to get to the general thing first, then I'll discuss some of the complications. Now again, some of this is by way of review, but most of you weren't here, so I'll go over it very briefly. Now obviously, the standard situation where you ask me to borrow $100 from me, obviously I can't charge interest. But the question is, what about bank accounts? Yeah.
Aren't you really not lending your money in bank accounts? Bankers, they lend other people's money.
Let's take it from two perspectives. We're not necessarily talking about the avera of the bank. Let's talk about you. When you start a checking account, a now account, they call it, or a savings account, right? What are you doing? You are lending money to the bank.
And I'm getting interest back.
That's right. And you're getting interest. So one question is, how can you, as an individual, get interest from a bank? And the second question is, if you borrow money from a bank, let's say to buy a car, and you're going to pay them back every month, you're paying interest, right? So what the bank does with your money perhaps is not your problem that much, because they're involved in that transaction. But you are both on the receiving end and sometimes on the giving end if you borrow money from the bank. So first of all, the central issue once again is, what is the status of, right, banks are incorporated, banks are corporations, banks are not individuals, so to speak. So the question is, what is the status of the corporation in Jewish law? If you have a corporation, all of whose shareholders are Jewish, or a majority of whose shareholders are Jewish, or it doesn't have to be a majority in number, but if 51% or 52% of the corporation's stock is held by a Jew, do I regard the corporation as Jewish or not Jewish? Now, as I'm sure all of you know, from a legal, secular legal standpoint, this is true in Israel, it's really true, I think, everywhere in the world, probably, a corporation is a separate, artificial, legal person. When a corporation makes a contract, that is an obligation of the corporation. That is not a personal obligation of a shareholder of a corporation. That is why people incorporate. That is why corporations can go bankrupt, and the guy that owns 100% of the stock could still be a millionaire, because it is the corporation that owes the money, not the individual. Right? Limited liability. That is why, one of the reasons why businesses incorporate. Now, a corporation is an artificial person. A corporation does not have a religion. Right? A corporation does not count for a minyan or put on tefillin or anything else. So the question is, when I pay interest to a corporation, or a corporation's assets pay me interest, is that a transaction between a Jew and a Jew? Or is it a transaction between a Jew and some artificial thing out there, which isn't a Jew, although it ultimately has an effect on a shareholder who is Jewish? Right? Now, if we say that halacha can accept, under one guise or another, the concept of the artificial person, then it would mean paying interest to a bank is not paying a Jew, it is paying a corporate entity. Taking interest from a bank is not taking interest from a Jew, but it's taking interest from a corporate entity. Now, this is a very, very pervasive issue that goes well beyond. It's a much, much bigger problem than the problem of interest, although that is a big problem. It's relevant, as I mentioned the other day, to chametz after Pesach. Right? You're not allowed to own or buy or use or eat any chametz product that was owned by a Jew during Pesach. This is called chametz she'avar alaf ha-Pesach, right? That's why, you know, if you're familiar with this, you know that after Pesach, we're always given a list of stores. Don't buy anything in this store till Lag Ba'Omer or something, when they've already, turned over their inventory or whatever it is. Why? Because if they didn't sell their chametz, then you, as a Jew, are not allowed to eat any of their chametz products till they got new stuff in that they didn't own during Passover.
These stores are owned by Jews?
Yeah, that's the list. In other words, you'll typically be given a list of various stores that are owned by Jews who didn't sell their chametz. Right? The Waldbahn's or whatever it is. And that could change from year to year, right? Because there's always mergers and acquisitions. So what's one year is a Jewish store, may next year not be a Jewish store, or what was not a Jewish store may become a Jewish store. And then again, I'm not going to get into all the halachas. You have to ask your local rabbi for that. But then, as you know, there's also a lot of questions about turnovers. In other words, when do you assume, right, there's been a turnover? That's a whole other question. Some people say Lag Ba'Omer, some people say Shavuos, some people say it depends on the store, some people say it depends on the product, right? But there's a lot of different things here. But I want to raise a more basic question, and that is, well, wait a second here. What is this issue about a so-called Jewish store? Every store, other than maybe, I'm not sure if every makolet on Shmuel HaNavi is incorporated, that may not be the case, but here they sell their chametz, don't worry about that. But certainly any big business is incorporated. What do you mean a Jewish corporation? I'm buying Waldbahn's. I'm buying the chametz that is owned by Waldbahn's. I'm buying the chametz owned by Safeway Corporation. Right? If halacha recognizes the concept of corporation as a separate identity, a separate entity, then there wouldn't be a Pesach problem either. Right? So it's a very important issue. Or what if I own shares in a corporation that owns chametz during Pesach? Well, I got to sell my shares with my bread. Right? So this is a very, very pervasive issue. Again, with respect to chametz, which is not the main thing I want to talk about today, with respect to chametz, Rav Moshe does rule that even if halacha recognizes the corporation as a separate identity, Rav Moshe says, if a corporation is controlled, this is the key word, if a corporation is controlled by a Jew, we'll define that in a moment, that would be enough to trigger the prohibition of using that chametz if it was owned during Pesach. And control is defined by either being an officer in the corporation, even if you don't own any stock, if you're a president or top echelon management, or he says, if you own enough stock in the corporation that you can direct the management to follow your bidding. That does not mean, by the way, it even has to be 51%, because in a large corporation in which there might be millions of shares, even a small amount as a block of 10% is so much more than anyone else may have that you can, in effect, call the shots. Right? So that was Rav Moshe's concept of control. But with respect to interest, Rav Moshe has also an unusual ruling. Rav Moshe paskins, halacha does recognize the corporation as a separate entity. Therefore, Rav Moshe says, you are allowed to receive interest from a bank, even though that bank is a Jewish bank, because you are not receiving an interest payment. Because when you established a checking account and you lent your money to the bank, you lent it to a corporation, not to the individual. Therefore, you're getting interest from the corporation, not from the individual. So Rav Moshe therefore says, you can get interest even if it's from a bank that is owned by a Jew. However, Rav Moshe then differentiated and said, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you borrowed money from a bank, you would not be allowed to pay a Jewishly controlled bank interest. What's the difference? I mean, is the corporation considered Jewish or not? So Rav Moshe's argument is that when you borrow money from the bank and you make interest payments, even though the interest payment itself is going to the corporation, but since it enhances the earnings of the corporation, that in turn increases the value, at least in a small way. I mean, your own dollar is not going to do that, but if you add everything up together, it increases the value of the shares of the corporation shareholders. Then Rav Moshe's argument was that payments to the corporation is an indirect payment for the benefit of the shareholders. It's not entirely clear why the argument doesn't apply the opposite way also. Yeah, it's a very difficult chiluk that he makes. But he does, but just in terms of the halacha, he does say, just to know this, that you are allowed to receive an interest payment from a corporation, a bank, even though the bank is owned by Jews. But he says the other way would be a problem. Yeah.
I'm trying to get a grasp on, historically, when was corporation recognized under Jewish law?
Well, there is a question whether corporations are even recognized under Jewish law. I mean, corporations are of one type or another. Well, the modern corporation is around 400 years old. There are some ancient precedents in Roman law even to corporations. And Jewish law has a reference to some types of bodies that today we would call corporations. For example, Jewish law talks about property owned by a city, by a government. And it does say property that is owned by a city is not the same as owned by the individuals who comprise the city. So there's still, as I'm saying, so part of the uncertainty about how halacha deals with a corporation stems from the fact that the Talmud does not seem to have that many types of corporations other than governments and the like. But the question becomes, once secular law has created such an entity, would halacha recognize the artificial existence of this newly created person? That's really the question. In other words, it's clear that a corporation is not indigenous to halacha. That much is certain. But the question is whether halacha would recognize it once it comes into being. That's the uncertainty in this area.
What happened after a motion? They this Paskin is the thing, and all the banks aren't exactly following this concept.
Well, obviously, if you borrow money from a Jewish bank, and you then read Rav Moshe's tshuva that you're not allowed to pay interest to the bank, you have a real problem. If you decide you're not going to pay interest, the bank is going to sue you and everything else. In a chinami, the eitzah would be, I'll discuss what you would do practically in the future, but the solution here would be, you're not allowed to borrow money from a Jewish bank if you're going to have to pay them interest. Once you're in the predicament, it's a separate matter. Now, so that's one thing. Now, again, just to run through very, very quickly, because I don't want to repeat everything, just to run through very quickly some common situations which involve interest, just so you'll be aware of the common situations. Situation number, and these are less obvious. In other words, a loan with interest is interest, right? That's not a question. But one situation is a discount for early payments. For example, I sell you merchandise on credit. I sell you merchandise on credit. And the invoice, the bill, says the following. The bill says the price of these goods are $100, but if you pay your bill within 30 days, you will get a 5% discount. In other words, it's $100, but you can pay but if you pay within a month, it'll cost you $95. Now, one can look at that superficially, and one could say, hey, I don't see any interest there. The price is $100, and you get a 5% discount. And yet, in the eyes of Jewish law, that is treated as an interest-bearing transaction. Why is that so? Because when I sell you an object, that generates a debt. You owe me the value of that debt. And if I create a differential where if you pay me sooner, you pay me less, and if you pay me later, you pay me more, then although you could call that a discount for early payment, but the other way of looking at it is that I will charge you $5 for holding on to my debt, for delaying payment of my debt for a longer period of time. Now, clearly, if it would have said it this way, the price of this is $95, but any payment after 30 will have a surcharge of $5 or 5%, that clearly would be interest because I'm charging you extra for a delay in payment. Well, this is an example of where halacha looks at the substance of the transaction rather than the form, and therefore, the same way it would clearly be interest if it would be described as a penalty for late payments, it is treated as an interest transaction when it is a discount for early payment. Now again, this is only between Jews, not with a guy involved. Okay, so that's one, you know, uncommon, or one example where a person would not necessarily see that there's interest, but in fact those are interest-bearing transactions. Another example is the opposite. This is where a buyer prepays in order to get a guaranteed delivery price for the future. Right? But the example is, if you give your cash up front, let's assume you're buying tefillin or refrigerators or furniture or anything else. And let's assume the tefillin haven't been written yet, or the furniture hasn't been made yet, or the refrigerator hasn't come in from the factory. And let's assume, as of today, the price is $500. In 6 months or a year, the price is going to be $1,000. The seller has the following deal with me. If you give me $500 up front, I guarantee that I will give you a refrigerator 6 months from now at $500, or tefillin, or furniture, even if the market price goes up to $1,000, right? Very, very common, a locked-in delivery price. Once again, we can't go over all of the details here. All of these transactions have a lot of details, but on its face, that is halachically treated as an interest-bearing transaction. Why? Because what the seller is effectively telling you is, hey, you're giving me the benefit of your money up front. When you give me money and I don't make delivery right away, you are lending me money. You are financing me in my business. And I will reward you by giving you something in the future, even if that future object is worth more than the money you're giving me today. Now, it's not definitive interest, because who says the object will go up? That's true. So it's not interest on a biblical level, because it's not a definite interest. But it does create the possibility of interest, and therefore if it goes up later, I'm giving you back $1,000 for the benefit of the advance of funds that you're giving.
What happens if market value goes down? Which is happening on the computer?
Well, this would depend very much on the deal, but generally speaking, unless it's a pure future, if it's a futures contract, etc., that's speculation, so the risk goes both ways. But in the typical small deal that you make with the Meir Sharon Tefillin guy, usually you would stipulate for a refund back. I mean, that's the way it usually works. In other words, he wants your money, and if it's worth the same or more, you'll have guaranteed delivery, and if not, you'll get a ratable refund. But you're correct, in a pure futures contract, it goes both ways.
So is there a futures market in Israel?
Well, as I say, okay, let me get to that, because all of these transactions are governed by another thing that we need to mention very, very briefly. So the guaranteed payment raises an interest problem. A third potential problem is commodities for commodities, even on a small scale. I borrow a ton of Xerox paper from you today, and I will return to you a ton of Xerox paper next week. Well, if Xerox or computer paper has gone up in the interim, right, I borrow something at a market value of $1,000, I give it back to you at a market value of $2,000 or $1,050. That is an interest payment, at least rabbinically. It's not a Torah interest because there was not any guarantee it would go up, but it's considered to be interest. This even applies, strictly speaking, to housewives who lend bowls of sugar to each other when they're insistent that they get exact equivalents. I lent you sugar on Monday when sugar goes for $5 a pound. You give it back to me on Tuesday when sugar goes for $5.50 a pound. You gave back more than you took. Okay? This applies to pledges. Let me give you a very simple example. Again, I'm giving you a lot of examples. I'm not resolving any of these. I just want you to see that the world of interest is a very, very broad and scary world, because all sorts of things can happen in which we don't even realize what's going on. I lend you $100. You give me your watch to hold on to until the loan is paid. I have a very simple collateral called a pledge, a mashgan in Hebrew. Well, do you know that if I use the watch just to tell time, I have to deduct the rental value of the watch from the outstanding balance of the loan? Because if I use the watch and in addition I get the loan paid, then principal of loan plus use of the collateral creates an interest charge. You see? If, on the other hand, we have some type of graduate, of course, and I would rather not use the watch and not deduct, but if we have some graduated rental value of the watch, very pervasive issue, and as I say, you can't get around it simply by the borrower being willing to pay interest, because that doesn't, that's not a heter. I should also emphasize as well that even an interest rate that is below inflation is halakhically considered interest, although from an economic standpoint it is not. So if, for example, the rate of inflation for commodities is at 10% and the interest rate is less than 10%, so in effect, when I borrow a dollar and I give you back, let's say, $1.05, I'm not giving you more than I gave you, than I took from you, because it buys less. But even if it buys less, it is still considered interest. In other words, interest is based on a comparison of the exact principal and what you're giving back. It is not based on comparative purchasing power. So even though under an economic definition, any interest rate below inflation is not considered interest, this is considered interest. Now, what is done in modern economies, and this goes back to the Middle Ages, is the document that is called the Heter Iska. Let me explain what a Heter Iska is. Heter Iska literally means permission to make an investment. And that is, many, many loans, particularly in Israel, and every bank works this way, are structured not as loans, they are structured as investment vehicles. What do we mean by an investment? If I give you $1,000 and I instruct you, invest that $1,000 for me in profit-making enterprises and we will split the profits, that is not an interest, right? That alone would not be an interest transaction, because that is simply profit sharing with my supplying capital and your supplying labor. Well, the Heter Iska is a document that basically says all lending transactions are treated in one way or the other as a form of investment with a profit sharing. The big problem, of course, with the Heter Iska is that's fine if the guy who borrows the money invests it in a profit-making venture and makes a profit. But what if the person invests the money in something and makes no profit at all? What if the person loses the money? In other words, I gave him $1,000 and at the end of the month he has no money at all. How do you then use the Heter Iska to get anything back? In other words, if it's a loan, I get my principal back. If it's an investment, I lose it. So the Heter Iska is a peculiar thing. What the Heter Iska says is the following. Let me give you a standard formula. It says the following. The transaction of advancing the $1,000 to Reuven, who is not called the borrower, he's called the recipient of an investment, Reuven agrees to invest this in profit-making enterprises. If Reuven alleges that there has been a loss of principal, meaning the money he was given has been dissipated, Reuven must prove the loss by bringing two kosher halachic witnesses who can testify that the money was lost. Meaning to say, halacha allows you to create a very high evidentiary standard to prove loss. Now, who are two halachically kosher witnesses? They're pretty hard to find. Number one, they have to be Jewish. Number two, they have to be two. Number three, they have to be male. They cannot be related to each other, nor can they be related to either of the parties. They have to be Shomer Shabbos. And I guess the most difficult of all is, how do you get two people who could actually give eyewitness testimony that the money was lost? And how do they actually know? So the point is, the ability to say that all losses must be proven by absolute eyewitness testimony that is kosher eliminates realistically the possibility, doesn't totally eliminate it, but eliminates the possibility that the borrower will be able to come back to me and say, I'm sorry, I don't have the principal anymore because it was generated via loss. Now, it then says, in terms of profits, in other words, the deal was to divide the profits. It then says that in order to establish what the profit was, the recipient of the funds must make a solemn oath on a Sefer Torah what the profits were, and in the absence of that solemn oath, he must pay a stipulated assumed profit of 10%. In other words, you tie it to the interest rate. And the Heter Iska was based on a great reluctance of people to make a solemn oath. So why does it still work is really kind of a mystery, because a lot of people don't care about making a solemn oath and they'd be perfectly willing to make it. And if you walk into any bank in Israel, you will see there is a Heter Iska on the wall, but it doesn't say what the Heter Iska says. It just says all transactions in this bank are governed by the Heter Iska of Rav Mendel of Krakow. Mendel of Krakow lived a few hundred years ago, and so typically you don't even know what you're doing, but many say that a Heter Iska is not valid unless you understand it. Okay, again, I just wanted to just mention this very, very briefly without going into all of it, but the Heter Iska is a way where de facto a person can get the equivalent of interest in regular lending transactions, without getting into all of the surah, the prohibitions of interest, because it is structured as an investment and a profit sharing, and the interest is stated as a presumed profit in the absence of making a solemn oath that the profit was greater or lesser, and that has tended to be the way businesses work. Okay, so that's just something just to be aware of, this very unique issur of interest. We do have, though, one other relationship that I wanted to discuss. We've been discussing my relationship to my competitors, my relationship to my customers, and to my lenders and borrowers. Sure.
Is this Heter Iska? This is not what Rav Moshe said. This goes against what he said, or?
No. These are two different things. Rav Moshe's Heter was that when you are receiving interest from a corporation, you don't need a Heter Iska. There is no prohibition on receiving interest from a corporation because the corporation is not Jewish. The
corporation can't receive interest from anything.
Right. Well, but all that was without a Heter Iska. In other words, Moshe was talking about in the absence of a Heter Iska, the corporation can give interest to you. You cannot give interest to a corporation. That is the standard in the absence of Heter Iska. However, once you make a Heter Iska, everything changes at that point, because in theory, the interest that you're giving back is a share in the profits that it's presumed that you made from the money that you got. Now, there's the Heter Iska changes every loan into something for which you use the money and you generated a profit.
You're not literally making a profit.
Well, the way the Heter Iska works is, even if you didn't make the profit, but the Heter Iska says that unless you're willing to make an oath in the sacred Torah that you didn't make a profit, the assumption is you made a profit. In other words, the Heter Iska creates an assumption. And the assumption is that the recipient of the funds agrees that he will account for all profits, assuming a profit of whatever the rate of interest is, 10%, unless he's willing to make a solemn oath on a Sefer Torah. So what the Heter Iska does is, the Heter Iska creates a presumption of profits equal to that rate of interest, unless you're willing to swear. Now, once you make a Heter Iska, then you can even pay to the corporation, because what you're paying under the Heter Iska is profits, not interest. Rav Moshe was talking about, where you did not make a hetzeris. Again, it's very peculiar, and I have to admit, I don't fully understand this either, because mechara like this. If I know, I'm the guy that borrowed the money. I know I didn't make a profit. I know I didn't invest the money in a profit-making venture. So, just because the heter iska says that unless I'm willing to swear the profit is assumed to be 10%, at most that might be a justification to allow the creditor to collect the interest, because the creditor can say, well, until he swore, I can make that assumption. But how can it be a heter for the borrower to do it when the borrower knows that's not the case? I mean, I'll give you an example. Let's take an example of kosher and treif. Right? The Gemara says in Maseches Chulin, if you have 9 stores that sell kosher meat and 1 store that sells treif meat, and you find a piece of kosher meat in the streets, and you don't know if it came from the 9 kosher stores or it came from the 1 treif store. So you know what the law is. The law actually is... A piece of unknown meat. Right.
Where in the street?
Let's say equally distanced from all the stores.
It was on the ground.
Oh, it's on the ground, yeah. I know it's not hygienic, but it's on the ground, yeah. Let's assume it's wrapped up. It's wrapped up. Yeah, we don't have to assume.
Coke,
that's right. Now, the halacha is, as you said, that if you don't know where something came from, you can assume it came from the majority rather than the minority. In other words, there's 9 times more of a chance it came from the kosher instead of the treif. So the guy that doesn't know is allowed to say, all right, it came from the kosher. But if I myself know, let's assume that I saw which store it came from, I can't rely on an assumption that it came from the kosher if I know it came from the treif. Now, even if you, so let's assume I tell you, hey, this came from the treif, you may not have to believe me, but I have to believe myself. So, l'chaira, don't you have the same type of dilemma with the heter iska? The heter iska creates a certain definition, meaning the heter iska says, it is assumed that all money that is represents an interest charge is really the profit that the borrower made under, it's not called the borrower, by the way, that the recipient of the money made on the transaction. Well, that might be something that the creditor might be allowed to assume. But how can the borrower assume it? And since the issur of ribis is not only on a creditor to take, it's also on a borrower to give, right? That was the earlier point that we made, the heter iska is a very difficult thing to understand. How can the borrower proceed on a presumption that the borrower himself knows is false? It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for that.
Could you have shocked this that it's too soon or over a target that it can't be answered for you to pay with this? There's no reason for someone to accept
it. It might be. You know, the issur on me to give is only when you have an issur to take. Could be. I hear. Yeah.
Why don't we create the same standard on the borrowers? Prove with kosher witnesses that you
know. Yeah. Logically, there ought to be. The Levush says that since loss of principle is a fairly uncommon thing, so we consider it to be within the rights of a advancer of funds to require the highest standard to prove that which is uncommon. Since profit is a more unusual thing, therefore we don't give the advancer of funds the right to impose the highest standard. But Shavua he could impose. That's Levush explained. That's why there's an asymmetry in the loss and the profit. But the bottom line is this. The bottom line is that the heter iska is hard to understand, and I admit it's hard to understand. But its fundamental concept is to convert the loan into investment. And this allows for bank loans, and this allows for all sorts of transactions. I could lend you $1,000. I wouldn't call it a loan, though. I could give you $1,000, and via heter iska, we could effectively create an arrangement where at the end of the year, I'll get back $1,010 or $1,020.
You would have to invest the money.
Well, but remember the way it works. He doesn't have to invest the money. See, the heter iska says that it is assumed, that's back to my question, it is assumed that you invested the money in a profit-making venture unless you're willing to swear on the sacred Torah that you did this. And therefore, when you pay me back, I'm allowed to take it because I'm allowed to treat it like investment money. Again, the question is, even though you know, that's the question, even though you know you didn't invest it, right? So that's the issue. That the heteriska says that certain things have to be proven a certain way, and if they're not proven that way, the issue doesn't, the prohibition doesn't apply. But again, the heteriska is not for, it's for adults only, as the expression goes, and one should really talk to, if one is involved in any type of transaction requiring a heteriska, one should discuss with a very competent posad. Yerushalayim has many, many bekiyim. The Badatz can help you out. The Eid HaRedis down the street can help you out with heteriskas and all of those things. In fact, the primary sefer on the laws of interest, very, very erudite, was written by one of the judges in the Eid HaRedis in Yerushalayim, so the Bris Yehuda. So they're certainly very experts in this particular area. I should mention another thing, though, and that is, it is still true that lending a person money interest-free, when it's a matter of tzedakah to help a person make a living, is a very, very great mitzvah. Even if you could get around it with a heteriska, if you can lend somebody money free. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim even writes, all of us are familiar with the idea that a person should give 10% of his income to charity, right? That's maaser. And the Chafetz Chaim writes that one of the best ways of giving this maaser is by creating a revolving free loan fund. In other words, I put in, let's say I earn $10,000, so I put in $1,000 in what's called a gemach. Gemach is an abbreviation, gemilas chesed, doing loving kindness, in which the money is lent out and people put it back in. It revolves, right? I lend it to you, you bring it back, I lend it to somebody else. And a gemach is considered to be the highest form of tzedakah. And therefore, even though we have mechanisms for heteriskas to facilitate commerce and transactions which are commercial in nature, but certainly making personal loans, one should not use a heteriska for those types of things, even though there are ways you could do it. Right, so that's just a little, very, very little about interest, just to be aware of what those issues are. Okay, the final aspect is really a totally new topic in the business ethics area, and that is my relationship to the government and the legal system under which I live. What are my ethical responsibilities towards the governments? Whether it's the government of Israel, or the government of the United States, whatever it is. So here, there is a fundamental principle that I'm sure you've heard of, needs to be defined, but at least we should be aware of it, and that's the principle of the great rabbi in the Gemara, the great Amora Shmuel, where Shmuel says, Dina de Malchusa Dina. Dina de Malchusa Dina. This is Aramaic. The law of the government is the law of the Torah. Now, that's what the statement literally means. Jews must obey, literally it says, the law of the government. Now, the Rashba, one of the great medieval commentators, already notes there's no way this statement can be as broad as it literally means. If the government, for example, were to say, you're not allowed to keep Shabbos, or businesses must be open on Shabbos, you certainly wouldn't obey them. If the government creates laws that says marriages are terminated by a divorce proceeding in a court without a get, you certainly don't listen to them, right? If the government says, we define kosher meat as anything that is killed in a way other than Shechita, you don't listen to them. The Rashba has a very strong, he says, Chas v'shalom, are we to say that all of the Dinei HaTorah simply get annulled because Dina de Malchusa Dina? So obviously this is a principle that needs to be limited in some particular way, and how it is to be limited is a vast, vast discussion of many, many, many opinions. However, there is a core meaning. In other words, there is at least one core of Dina de Malchusa Dina that every single opinion agrees upon. There'll be other aspects we'll talk about. But if we had to find a common denominator, what is the one area where Dina de Malchus Dina absolutely applies without equivocation, and that is the area of taxation. It's very, very clear, in other words. If the government levies a tax obligation on someone, one is halachically obligated to comply with that tax obligation. In other words, tax evasion is not only a violation of federal law, violation of Title 26, Title 18, right, the criminal code, but it is a violation of Jewish law. That is because of the principle of Dina to Malchusa Dina. It's very interesting that you may ask, how does Shmuel know Dina to Malchusa Dina? Is it a pasuk? You know, Shmuel just comes out of the blue and says, there's a new rule, Dina to Malchusa Dina. The Gemara does not tell us how he knows it. Right? It's a very big chiddush. How does he know such a thing? So the truth is there are a few different sources that Rishonim and Achronim give from Dina to Malchusa Dina. One is a source in a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, the book of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, when the Jews were sent into exile during the Babylonian Gullus. Right? Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. So many Jews had given up hope. They thought, this is the end of our life. We'll never be able to survive. So Yirmiyahu told them, Dirshu Shalom Hoir, seek the welfare of the society that you're going to. Build houses, plant vineyards. In fact, Dirshu Shalom Hoir, seek the welfare is the source for the teaching in Pirkei Avos, that one should always pray for the welfare of the government, Shlomo Shel Malchus, because without the government, one person would swallow another person, right? That's why many shuls, there's a prayer for the United States in America, prayer for Israel. Now it's a bit more controversial for various other reasons. But this is based on the teaching of Pirkei Avos, Dirshu Shalom Hoir. Of course, you know the way the Kutzke Rebbe defined it. What does it say in Pirkei Avos? It says, pray for the welfare of the government. He says, he defines it this way, pray when the government has welfare. He was actually making the point that when the government is off fighting wars, at least they're not bothering the Jews, says in Poland, etc. He says, but you should be mispalel bishleima shal malchus. When the malchus has shalom, that's when you start praying, because things are going to get tough. But okay, but the simple meaning is that you pray for the peace of the malchus. So some achrayim say that the concept dirshu, what does dirshu mean? Seek, is a chiyuv on us to be law-abiding citizens of the country that we live in, and therefore that is a mocker of Dina to Malchusa, that is the source of Dina to Malchusa Dina. There is another source that's even more intriguing, and this is Rashi and Gittin. Rashi and Maseches Gittin. Rashi and Gittin says the source of this rule that a Jew is halachically obligated to obey the laws of his society is found in the seventh Noahide law. Remember the seven commandments of Noah that all of humanity is given. The seventh commandment of Noah is the obligation to establish a legal and judicial system to administer justice in a fair and equitable way. Rashi says that since laws that are promulgated based on that criteria are a fulfillment of the Noahide mitzvah of Dinan, they bind Jewish people. That's a big chiddush. See what Rashi is doing? Rashi is saying, in other words, whatever Noahide society does in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Dinan, Dinan is to administer justice, becomes halachically binding on Jews. In other words, we are subject to the Noahide laws that are promulgated by non-Jews. So that is the rule of Dina to Malchusa Dina. Now, therefore, when Jews engage in tax evasion, when Jews do not pay their obligations to the government, not only is that in itself a tremendous chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name, which is bad enough, it is certainly bad enough, but in addition, it is also considered to be a form of theft, because the obligation to comply arises. In other words, when there's an obligation of Dina Malchusa Dina, that means it's money I halachically owe the government. If it's money I halachically owe the government, it would be theft for me not to pay that particular obligation. Now, Ad Kedei Kach, that Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, once paskins, this is a very unusual psak, he said, you know, there are businesses that sell merchandise on cash. right? So you go and you buy things, and they don't take checks, they don't take credit cards, they only take cash. And the assumption is, people generally assume, that the reason they only take cash is because that way there's no record of how much they received, and in that way there is sales tax, right? Because let's assume that on clothing there would be a 5% tail tax. That means that the merchant is supposed to send 5% of the money into the state. If it's a cash business, the state can't really prove. It's much more difficult for the state to prove how much money was received. So Rav Soloveitchik paskens, at least I heard this, that you're not allowed to buy merchandise from a store that only does business for cash, because since you are assisting them in being able to evade taxes, so you are transgressing. Now, what are you transgressing? See, they're not paying the tax, they're transgressing Dina Demoklus Adina. That's their Aveira. What's your Aveira? Your Aveira is not putting a, right, Lifnei Iver, not putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person, meaning don't do something that causes others to transgress. So we actually paskened that patronizing such a business is a violation of Lifnei Iver Mosite Mifshel.
Totally a huge problem.
Well, there's a way out. Now, here's the thing. Two little horrors, and that is, horror number one is, observation number one is, so you might ask this question, how come you sometimes see so many apparently religious people who are, don't seem to be so meticulous in the paying of taxes and obligations to the government? So I once had this thought many years ago, which I heard Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky confirmed, and that is, many Jews came from countries like Russia, Poland, etc., Hungary, which were virulently anti-Semitic and discriminatory against Jews. Now, it's brought down in Halacha that in order for Dina de Malchus Adina to apply, it only applies to taxes and regulations that are applied equally across the board and do not unfairly discriminate. But rules that unfairly discriminate against Jews because they're Jews, that's not called Dina, that's not called law, that's called Gazlanusa, that's called extortion. So it could be that here we have a mistaken concept of old Minhagim, meaning to say, they come from Poland and Russia, and the concept was, well, in the olden days, you know, we smuggled, and in the olden days we cheated, and this was the Minhag, and Gedolim permitted it, therefore. But one might suggest that this is a mistaken transplantation of a custom that was justified in a certain society that would not be justified in another society. So I hear that Yaakov Kamenetsky actually said that. He basically said that this was a mistake. People were allowed, in other words, you were allowed in some cases to cheat in Poland and Russia because these were taxes that were blatantly anti-Semitic and anti-discriminatory, which were not applied across the board. It would not apply in modern society. Yeah.
The biggest thing that comes to mind is the taxi meters.
Yes.
The whole reason they don't want the meter on, yes, so they don't have to pay tax, there's no record of it. Now, yeah, is that okay? I once heard somebody say, well, you can't survive in Israel, it's too difficult, like, you know, playing by the book.
Well, this brings us to a second issue, and this is the second issue I want to do. There is a shita of the Ran, an opinion of the Ran, again, very controversial also, and this is not, I'm not giving any definitive halach, I'm just giving you views here. The Ran says that the rule of Dina de Malchus Adina does not apply in Israel. In the state of Israel. And this is now the Ran wrote this before there was a state of Israel. The Ran wrote this back in the 1400s. But the Ran's argument is, the Ran gives a third basis for Dina de Malchus Adina. In other words, I mentioned the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, seek the welfare of the government, and I mentioned Rashi, B'nai Noach, have a right to make laws, etc. The Ran gives a third view, and that is, Dina de Malchus Adina is the rent that a government can charge for occupancy. Meaning, if a Jew is given the right to live in Poland or Russia or America, the government can charge him rent. And the rent that the government charges is obedience to its laws. But in Israel, says the Ran, there is no government that has the right to tell me I don't have the right to be here. And therefore the concept, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish government, therefore the concept of Dina de Malchus Adina as a rental obligation simply does not apply. Now, Do we paskin like the Ran? It depends which rabbi you ask. You can ask. No, I'm telling you the truth. You can ask certain poskim, and they will tell you that you can rely on the Ran, that Dina de Malchusa Dina does not apply in the land of Israel. Other poskim will paskin differently. And of course, it gets enormously complicated when we consider the fact, well, gee, the Ran was talking about a hypothetical non-Jewish state in Israel. In other words, when Israel was conquered, what is the status of a Jewish state? And as one might argue that a Jewish state is not even Dina de Malchusadina. It might be a different thing. It might be the din of a regular Jewish king. And that creates more problems. In other words, it's not even clear that the relevant halachic category for a Jewish state is Dina de Malchusadina. It might in fact be some other category, such as a Jewish king and the like. So it's a very complicated area. My own view would be, if you'd ask me, again, this is not a psak at all, is that one should try to be strict in these matters, and it would be better to get the cap to turn on the meter and everything else. But there is a basis to be lenient. Yes, sir?
What about
restored
then? It doesn't want to deal with credit. It's only subjected to the fear of checks around. Did you receive that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. Meaning, you don't have to automatically assume that cash businesses are trying to cheat the government. And you're entitled to judge them favorably as well. And they may have reasons. They don't want checks because they might bounce, and they don't want credit cards because there's paperwork there. So under those circumstances, if it's not clear to you that it's a tax evasion scheme, I don't think you have any problem. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow. Yes, one more session of business, please.